Always Another Country is a story about my sisters and I and my family. I was born to a South African father who left South Africa when he was 21 years old and slipped out of the country, and it was not my father yet, and went and did military training in Russia because he was joining a new army that was going to be an underground armed wing of the African National Congress, which was Nelson Mandela's Freedom Party. And the idea was that it was clear that the stance of nonviolence that the ANC had used thus far was not working. So there was a radical new generation of young people in the late 1950s, early 1960s who wanted to take up arms. And so that's what my father did. And so I grew up as part of this revolutionary community of kids who were raised in the hopes and aspirations of a free South Africa. And the dream came true. And in 1994, South Africa was, we had our first democratic elections, and we voted the white minority regime out of power. And it was a peaceful transition. And so the world has always, of course, been interested in South Africa. But for me, it meant that we came home. And that was wonderful. The idea of how we have then made democracy and liberation and freedom real for ourselves has also been the kind of preoccupation of my life. So once you are free, are you really free? This is the question that the book seeks to answer. Once you are home, if you have been deprived of home for so long, is it ever really home? Those are the questions I wanted to answer.
How old were you when you went home?
So I was 17 when Nelson Mandela was released, and it was the most exciting thing that had ever happened in my life. We were living in Kenya at the time, and he was released in February of that year. And my father was very reluctant about coming home because many of the freedom fighters thought that it was a trap. And that this minute they came in, they would be arrested, and that this would be a setback. And I was too young and too dumb to not trust it. And I was living with another family at the time and completing my last year of high school. And they started to, another South African family, and they made a plan to come home, to travel to South Africa. And I just tagged along. I said, I'm coming. And so I went home when I was 17 and met my cousins for the first time and met my grandmother and met my grandfather. And
wow.
It was pretty incredible seeing all these people who look like you physically. You share genes, you sound similar, your voice, and yet you've never seen them before. So I went home for the first time when I was 17, and then I voted in the first elections in 1994. And then I moved home just after I finished university, which was in 1997.
Okay.
Yeah.
What does the title of the book mean?
I grew up living in many different countries. My first 7 years were in Zambia. Then we lived in Kenya. We moved to Canada because we needed a state. We were stateless children. Had a family, had a country, but we didn't have a state. And so we moved to Canada when I was 10, moved back to Kenya when I was 14, finished my high school there. My rest of my family went to Ethiopia. So it was always another country. I moved to the US. So always another country is quite literal. And then, of course, always another country is also a metaphor for the idea of freedom. So freedom always belongs somewhere else. It's an ideal and an idea we've always been chasing. And that very much remains part of the reality of the new South Africa, that freedom still belongs in this country that we are hoping to build.
You are an anti-racist activist, and you've said that Australia represents another South Africa with less black people. Could you explain that a little, because that's kind of, I was kind of like, oh, I wonder if that's what you meant by always another country. That's kind of,
yeah.
There's always more racism to fight.
There is, and that's true. So that's why that at a metaphorical level, it just worked so well for me. I was like, oh yeah, there's always another battle. There's always another dream, right? Look, Australia is like many white settler colonies. embedded in its founding moment is violence and racist violence. And so because every country in this world sees itself as exceptional, and every national identity is defined by those exceptionalisms, you know, so Americans think that they're exceptional because they're the biggest in the world and that makes them the best, you know, like everyone has their own take on why they're special. Yeah. And so Australia's sense of specialness as this, you know, lucky country, this place where egalitarianism thrives, is like all national myths, simultaneously true and untrue. And if you look at the founding moment, of course, it's not luck, it's violence that allows the country to thrive. and it's not an egalitarian system if you factor in the cost of that egalitarianism and who it excludes. So if you have to kill Indigenous people in order for your society to be egalitarian, there are lots of questions that it raises. And so obscuring the truth allows us to believe these things about ourselves. And in the case of racism, of course, obscuring the truth allows you to consider yourself to be non-racial, not racist. So the lies upon which national identity are founded in every context play themselves out in how then the people who are erased are treated, right? And in the Australian context, the worst forms of racism, and there are many forms of racism, but the worst forms of racism in the Australian context are exercised and used to punish Aboriginal people simply for having been there. And the denial around that, I think, is what very much defines very much of the conversation that Australians are having today. Mm. The conversation isn't about racism in the past and how the country deals with it. The conversation is about denying that racism exists, which is hugely distracting and tiring, but also very disheartening for those who are not in a position to debate the reality of racism because it plays itself out in their lives on a daily basis, right? So to even begin to have to prove it is such a waste of time.
Yeah. I'm going to come back to Australia, if that's okay, and New Zealand. I want to talk about word choices.
Mm-hmm.
Would you be able to give us your analysis on the term terrorist and freedom fighter and why the distinction is important?
What a great question that I was not expecting.
We had a... I don't know if you heard about the terror raids here in New Zealand.
Terror raids?
Yeah. In 2007, we had sort of militant police move into a very Māori and very small community on the East Coast with the claims that there was a militant terrorist group training in the bush there. And what happened was, I mean, the visuals of it is that you see very armed police making children get off buses and, you know, searching. There was like a roadblock. There was just this whole thing. It was an absolute spectacle. And it was actually targeting sort of environmental and anti-racist activists.
Yeah.
One of whom is very well known in this country, Tamaiti. He's got a full face moko.
Yeah.
He's got this reputation, I suppose you'd say. But you also, if you know him in Te Ao Māori, he's this really lovely koro, you know, he's the granddad. And so anyway, this became the Uruwera raids, it was called, against these terrorists. Mm. So that, and I was 13 or something, 14 when that happened, and that trauma is still there. People are still being affected by the court cases that came after, which no terrorist allegations were found, all of this sort of thing. But that was kind of my first real, like, actually, I know these people, they're freedom fighters, they're not terrorists, of what course. Are you even saying? So kind of
where the question comes from.
I mean,
so for us growing up, of course, the word that my father was called, and that whole, all of them were called terrorists. That's how they were named. There was legislation that the apartheid regime put in place that deliberately targeted terrorists. I was just telling somebody now that one of the first things that we did when we, when black people came into power in South Africa in 1994 was to abolish the death penalty, because the death penalty was used to kill terrorists, so it was used against us. Anyway, so the language of terror was definitely employed by the apartheid regime. And it's interesting because that language disappeared from my vocabulary. I always understood it to mean freedom fighter in reverse. So what the people that we called freedom fighters were terrorists to them, right? So I always understood that as a child. And then for many years, the word terrorism completely dropped from my mind. We were free. We didn't use that language. There was no use for that term. It completely disappeared from my vocabulary and my mind. And it was reinvoked after 9/11. So terrorism then re-enters my life. there was a long period in which people weren't called terrorists. And then it comes back, into use as we know today how the word terrorist is used in very particular ways.
Very deliberately.
And terrorism has a skin color. And that skin color is brown and black. And it's only now with what's happened with the Christchurch massacres, where at a mainstream level around the world, you finally have the acceptance of the notion of terrorism as something that is used to make people en masse fearful. And that a white supremacist is in fact a terrorist, and that, is a huge step forward. There's this thing that happens where conversations amongst certain communities that I held openly, language that we use will stay within our circle of comfort, and then there will be a moment, an opening, and that language is allowed to enter the mainstream.
Right.
And those moments happen very infrequently, but when they happen, it's really important to recognize them. And this has been such a global moment with Christchurch. And it's because somebody from that outer group, from the mainstream, sees, understands the politics, recognizes the word, and then takes it and co-opts it. And they are able to co-opt it in a way that doesn't diminish its power, mm-hmm. but that increases its power that we have always held and known. That hidden transcript versus the public record, that meshing is precisely what happened with the word terrorism very recently. So I don't disagree with you necessarily, but I do think it's important to mark the moment and to mark it as progress. Hidden transcripts. I did a thing on it because it's been such an issue in South Africa for many years in our country. University students who were suffering and struggling and did not have enough money to go to university were getting there on government scholarships, and our institutions have been historically white. That's continued. So they allowed us in, but the framework for the university wasn't decolonized. So what that then means is that many black students were going to university, but they didn't have money for anything else. And so sleeping, in the library, just all of these families having to sell goats and livestock to, right? Because education is so important. And what happened was all of our families were having these private conversations about what it took and how much our children were suffering. And the university had no idea because that space doesn't listen to, that's a private conversation. And when the students decided to protest, suddenly they burst that bubble. And there were all of these stories that suddenly the mainstream, largely white press were like, how can children be sleeping in the library? And I'm like, everybody knows this, right? So this is this piercing of the bubble.
And I find that also a really incredibly positive way of looking at it, which is awesome, because you could also say that, like, yes, these are private conversations happening, but also people do say things about them, but they're largely ignored,
exactly.
not platformed,
exactly.
all of those things.
Which is why I always disagree when people talk about the voiceless. Nobody's voiceless. We're always talking. You're just not necessarily listening, or you haven't tuned into the right channel, or you've chosen to ignore. I mean, that's those with power can afford not to hear, right? If you have power, You don't have to hear everybody. You don't have to understand another language if you have power, right? So definitely.
Yeah, and that the choice of words, again, there's such power in words. My mum always says, like people say here, the Maori language was lost, but she's like, no, it was systematically removed.
Exactly.
Actually.
Yeah, actually.
So still with word choices, in your 2015 TED Talk, talks about how there's nothing radical about believing in non-racism in regards to the four Mandelas. So something I think a lot about in this profession, I've already said this probably, is the way things are framed anyway. Mm. Especially questions, you know, how important is it as a writer to acknowledge the power of words? And also I think in your 2016 TED Talk you talk about the power of storytelling and their limitations.
Yeah, so for me I think words are everything, and whether we're using those words consciously or unconsciously also matters, right? So sometimes it's about our blind spots. Sometimes we're not choosing certain words, and it's because we don't know those words. It's because we haven't framed those ideas as carefully as we ought to. So the choice of words really matters. And not in some kind of... it's come under critique, but I'll say it, you know, not in a politically correct way, but actually in a very powerful way. You have to be careful with your words because they represent your ideas. And we are animals of communication, right? As human beings, that's the thing that it's all we have. It's our only real skill, to be honest. And so it is something that I take very seriously. Mm. Yeah.
You talk about needing the media or needing credible information from media institutions, but that the always happening search and fight for justice requires curious audiences. Mm. So we don't really have probably either of those right now.
I think we've got a little bit of both and not enough of either. I do worry that we are in a time where the very notion of reason is under attack. And that speaks to this idea that everything can be fake. Mm-hmm. And yet some things are not fake. And one of the things that is not fake is that the planet is under incredible stress from the things that certain human beings have done to it, mm-hmm. that we all, as human beings, must now pay the price for those things that a relatively small group of people with a pioneering spirit, the idea of possession, which has dispossessed so many of us, is deeply painful, but also has caused significant scars on the earth. Yeah, this is not subject to debate. This is not something that I can kind of parse with you. Well, maybe it's a bit. No, this is fact, right? And the very real function of debating these questions that we know are real is to distract us from solving them. So it's a very difficult and dangerous moment that we find ourselves in. And I really do worry about the questioning of everything because it has a political purpose. Of course, the thing that will resolve that is to generate and inspire, it's going to sound cheesy, but I'm going to say it, more rather than less love. Because in fact, so much of what the other side wants to do is polarize, incite hatred, and hatred is the thing that drives all of this terrible stuff we've done to this planet, you know? So I think so love only is born out of curiosity. Yeah, I will never, if I never get to know you, there's no possibility for love. Mm. Whereas the more we know one another, the more love, whether it be an intimate love or a love of you, meaning a respect, which is what love is really in my culture, the more that it's possible. So the solution to this issue is more love, and love comes out of curiosity. It's born out of curiosity, and the more we share, the more we make one another curious about one another, the more capacity we have to listen to one another. So, complicated times.
You quote Alice Walker, who said, "Look closely at the present you are constructing. It should look like the future you are dreaming." Some scholars have found here in New Zealand, and I don't doubt it's similar in other colonial countries, that a lot of the narratives about Indigenous populations or other oppressed minority groups are often very negative.
Mm.
While these stories are very much a reality, and therefore, you know, do have their place, how important is it that we ensure other sides of those stories are accessible in stories and film?
Yeah, I was shook when I moved to Australia. I was like, what's going on here? Hey, the stories are all stories of deficit. Every story is a story of only of struggle. And even in moments, like, I grew up in a struggle family, right? This was our entire purpose, was freedom fighting. There was a lot of laughter in our house, right? So this idea that somehow oppressed people have no other range of emotion, that the register of oppression is only gloom, is like so foreign to me. So I was like, what is happening here, right? And then of course you talk to Indigenous people, you talk to, you know, Noongar mates, and they're like, come on, you know. So again, it's that hidden conversation, yeah, versus public script, right? So the public script, which is what movies are, which is what, you know, all these all these other things, they operate at a certain level, which is and they have a power, but it is not to say that they are the real thing. They are one dimension.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that idea of who people really are and how they actually express themselves, that's always the story I'm interested in, right? I'm always interested in that story. So I'm always very skeptical of the big narrative thing that's going on, and I'm always like, who am I going to find? Which is why it was so great to read your piece. I was like, all right, now I know. Okay, this is peeling away. Okay,
yeah.
You know, all this New Zealand, shiny. I'm like, okay, what's behind the curtain, right? So that's always much more interesting, much more important,
yeah.
And to use a word that I know is highly subjective, much more true,
mm-hmm.
Of people and of places. Yeah.
So I guess back to how we're talking about that, the voicelessness,
yeah,
kind of conversation. Does this mean, you know, more money into these areas?
Yeah. It does. It means more money, more investment. It means more accountability from those who hold the resources and decision-making power, of, you know, about approving, you know, scripts and screenplays and all of that stuff. Because you can't make decisions that exclude so many people and then consider yourself to be democratic or consider yourself to be representative. So there is a it's not just about, because often I think these conversations are about like doing the right thing and like just being nice.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not about being nice. It's actually about being accountable. If you're spending taxpayer resources and you're like an arts funding council, you're not being accountable if you are not spreading those resources appropriately, right? If certain stories are systematically being excluded because you can't see them, you're not doing your job properly, right? Yeah.
Back to Australia. Something you've talked about before is this move to reconciliation and forgiveness rather than redistribution and justice. And you talk about this in regards to Mandela, but I think it's applicable in Australia and New Zealand. There's also this attitude in terms of discussions around racism being co-opted by the perpetrator's emotion. So we've got you've called the spectacle of black and brown grief and then white guilt.
Yeah.
And white guilt especially misdirects the conversation.
Yeah.
There's a few things to unpack there, but the main question is, how do we get to redistribution and justice?
Yeah, yeah. I have to say that in the Australia context, which I know better than the New Zealand one, and the New Zealand context feels further along and
I have a question
more
about that.
Politically viable than Australia. But again, I say this from a place of, like, literally, that's a superficial observation. So let me talk about what I know, which is in South Africa, where the demographics actually really matter, right? So in terms of our ability to shape the conversation, right? So we won. And so we also won the power to reframe the conversation, and we've lost that. So we reframed it, but then we did it in such a way that was beholden to white guilt, because of international markets, because of all these other external factors, that there are some things that I think Australia and New Zealand can learn about that. So in South Africa, you know, I wrote a piece a few years ago called The Strongest Victims in the World, because there is a way in which conversations about racism, as you say, continually get co-opted by racists. And white South Africans were continually taking up all the oxygen when it came to those discussions. And we had a number of incidents of interracial violence in South Africa in recent years. And in every single incident, the perpetrator was a white man and the victim was a black person, right? And so I called them the strongest victims in the world, because the language of victimization, you would think that they are the victims, and yet they have so much power, including continued physical power in terms of bashing people. So there really is something wrong when you are so strong and yet you are a victim. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So they really occupy the space as the strongest victims in the world. So that remains a really big issue. At the same time, you have this overarching narrative. When people talk to you about South Africa, they will often want to talk about how much they love Nelson Mandela because he forgave white people. And that's just not true. So that's the first problem, is that it's not true. Is that Nelson Mandela was managing a very deep and real sense of anxiety about white violence, which was a real factor in scuppering our progress towards giving black people freedom, was the backlash of white violence. And so Mandela's preaching of forgiveness may sound like really palatable to lots of people, and so they choose to ignore that the reason why forgiveness was necessary was in part in order to manage white violence. Mm. That if we did not forgive them, and it came down to it, that the very real threat in South Africa's path towards democracy was never black people's violence. It was, as has always been the case around the world, the specter of white violence is what shaped the world. Everywhere where white people have gone, they have wrought untold violence on black people, even where their numbers are fewer, as in this case. So that's the real thing about this forgiveness narrative. We had little choice about that. And so then to have Saint Mandela and white people saying, well, how can you be angry when Mandela forgave us? Mandela forgave you as part of a narrative that was necessary in order to secure us freedom. Mm. So you should just thank him and let's move on. So that's a separate conversation. Structurally, justice then. And of course, it was not a blank check, right? So the forgiveness framing that we crafted together as a country was this idea that if there is contrition, if white people say sorry, and sorry was very conditional and very particular, the sorry was you have to say sorry that you really genuinely, your heart, understand what you did collectively as a society, and secondly, make reparations. Mm. So the sorry must come with truth-telling. You must tell us where the bodies lie. So we literally went through a 5-year process of investigations, finding people who were killed, where they were buried, where their remains were, and giving restitution to families. So it was very concrete. It's not an abstract.
It's very physical.
It's very physical, yeah? So sorry, tell us where the bodies were and confess so that we can find our people. And then lastly, make reparations. So as a society, land restitution, a whole range of things, which have fizzled over time in South Africa, but were certainly in place and part of what recrafting a new society looked like, not just an apology. So conversations about reconciliation, and I do think reconciliation is important because I think it's part of every indigenous culture in the world is one that believes that things can be repaired. Because our societies were built on such a close affiliation with land, it meant that things had to be repaired. This is how the earth works, right? So I believe that reconciliation is important, but it can't be given without justice.
Mm.
And so justice has a particular shape that it has to be constructed by the society that's doing it. So I can't say what that might look like in New Zealand or in Australia, but certainly in the South African context, it looked like land. and that's part of why we are, again, in this moment in South Africa, where we are, again, restuck on this conversation about land.
Yeah. Okay, so you would say that you haven't reached a point of justice. Do you think that, you know how you just talked about this, the forgiveness as part of a narrative, there's still this threat of a backlash of white violence. You've today, the people are saying that white people in South Africa are the ones that are...
Yes, the genocide against white people, which is a fiction. But again, none of these fictions, like all writing, none of these fictions spring unbidden from the imagination. This is a historical idea of being surrounded by the savage, being having the civilizing mission, constantly being under threat. This is the story that white people in Africa always told themselves at precisely the same moment in which they were wielding guns, carrying out massacres, clearing tracts of land, destroying the earth, or seeding the beginnings of its destruction, all of that stuff. All of this stuff has always been happening simultaneously at the very same moment that the narrative is being told about being victims and being under threat. You are the threat, and you are talking about how you are being threatened. It's always a source of fascination to me.
So, I suppose New Zealand and Australia, both colonial nations, often here in New Zealand we pat ourselves on the back for not being as racist as Australia, because apparently that's the benchmark.
it's always good to have a benchmark that's better than you, supposedly.
Well, exactly. Yeah. Right? So it's not actually a useful discourse, because it's a completely different context in many ways. Some similarities, of course. Yeah, I suppose what I'm trying to say is, one, the comparisons aren't helpful. How do we move past that?
We
need to move past it.
Yeah, we do. I think also because the comparison is never made in relation to a place that is the best. The comparison is always made according to the lowest bar, which already tells you that the comparison has a politics built into it. The comparison is designed to make you look better. So then what's the point, right? So then that's a politics, and that's a particular choice. You were talking about word choice. Comparison choice is a politics.
Okay, finally back to the book, Home and Exile. Can you explain this a little more, especially in terms of your choice to live in Perth, Australia, and your mother's teachings around home being a concept that is independent of the approval of the place we are in?
So my partner is Australian and is from Perth, and so that's how we find ourselves living in Perth, which is definitely not... Living outside of South Africa is something that's very hard for me because it was such a hard-fought homecoming. So it's something I grapple with all the time, actually. Like, that's an open wound. That's not something around which I'm settled or resolved, but it is the way that it is. And we have a nice life, and the kids are happy, and all of that stuff. But it's definitely... it's sore. I miss home very actively all the time, and hence I'm home a lot. I'm in South Africa a lot, and so in some ways I guess part of how I've always lived my life is to do both, and I don't like the either or. I don't like the slash, so I prefer the hyphen. I live a hyphenated existence. And exile is one of those words, like refugee, that's a choice. We always called ourselves exiles, and we called ourselves exiles because it's a word that gives context. Just like freedom fighter, it's a word that you claim and that you own and that gives you value, that has a pride, even an arrogance. And refugee is something that somebody else tells you you are. a refugee is something that a bureaucrat decides. It's a basis of a certain small claim that you can make about money every month. And so while we were refugees, we were also exiles. Mm. And always self-defined as exiles. And so the people that we today flippantly call refugees are in fact exiles. They have left their home for a reason, and they too are fighting for freedom. And I think it's good to think about how we call what we call people versus what people would like to be called themselves. Mm. My mom did teach us to have a very strong sense of home in ourselves. And it's a lesson I am very happy that she taught us, because there is so much about the world we live in and the planet that is insecure, unstable, ruptured, disrupted, whether or not it was of our own making, that is the reality. And so when I think about what I want for my own children, it is for them to have within themselves the resources that allow them to be anywhere and to feel at home. That is, to be curious about other people, to be able to give and receive love from other people, as well as to hold that within themselves. And so that, to me, ultimately is it as close as a definition as I'm willing to give on what home is. So,
I also saw a tweet about your book saying that it forces one to see and make peace with their own contradictions. What do you make of that, or what do you hope people take away from the book?
Yeah, the older I get, the more important that is to me, the idea that we are full of contradictions, and that, in fact, it's our contradictions that make us able to be humble, that our contradictions are the basis upon which we can be criticized and improve ourselves, but that also make us who we are and idiosyncratic, right? And so I do hope that my book points out my own contradictions and allows people to think about their own contradictions. So I very much wrote it, in some ways it's a love letter to South Africa. It is about my desire to make that country my home, a desire that I think that I've fulfilled, but also the sense of constantly being an outsider in every place that I go, because that is the nature. Once you have grown up outside of that place that you want to be home, you will, in some ways, it will never, you can't get that time back, yeah? And part of writing a love letter to South Africa is also to comment on class and on the real elitism that developed in the 20 years. So we fought for freedom, we got that freedom, and then many people turned around and used that freedom to secure for themselves incredible wealth, while many other people continue to live in abject poverty. Mm. So as a middle-class person who already, by the time South Africa became free, had the tools, which was an education, which our parents invested in so heavily, but I got an education because I lived outside, that people inside never would have had an opportunity to get. So I was lucky, and to be able to comment on that luck and to say, that's also a power. I have power. I have a middle-class status, which allows me all these opportunities that aren't because I'm smarter or better, but that are just a result of dumb luck that my dad was the one who left, right? So to be able to hold that and to say, how do I use that power and how do I allow myself to admit that power, that privilege, that has to, I have to do that, in part because I'm interested in a national conversation about why white people don't do that enough. So I can't call you out on your stuff and then you can't call me out on my stuff.
Right.
We have to own it.